There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
Imposter syndrome. I think, as we said, 70% of people worldwide suffer from this, even if they haven't really been able to put a name to it.
Absolutely.
Which I think is a really interesting thing. At the clinic, is it something you have people coming in to talk to you about?
Oh, yes. And it's what I will say about imposter syndrome. It was interesting when you were saying, do you feel this way? Do you feel that way? Do you ever feel like, you know, I can just imagine how many heads are nodding along to answering some of those questions. So when we see it, it's usually in relationship to other struggles. So, for example, depression or anxiety that people might be experiencing. So it's definitely something that so many more people than you expect, particularly high functioning, you know, people that seem like incredibly high achievers. I mean, you mentioned some big names, Albert Einstein, Meryl Streep, Maya Angelou. These are people we hold in amazing esteem.
It really is. And Mike Myers, Will Smith,
yes.
Someone that, you know, we consider to be super confident and, as you say, super successful, mm-hmm. are actually filled with self-doubt.
Sure. And yeah.
So it's something we're talking about this afternoon. And if you've got any concerns about this, please do get in touch. 4001. 70% of people suffering from imposter syndrome. We've got a clip here. This is Dr. Valerie Roberts, who's an author and an expert on the subject, talking about imposter syndrome.
It was two psychologists in the late 1970s, Dr. Pauline Clance and Dr. Suzanne Imes, who first coined the term the imposter phenomenon, as it is more accurately known in the world of psychology. And they found in their research at a university in Georgia, despite overwhelming, compelling evidence to the contrary, a lot of perfectly intelligent, capable, competent people have a really hard time internalizing or really owning their achievements. And instead, they discount them or diminish them and kind of chalk them up to things like luck, timing, connections, they just like me, computer error. I've heard some very creative excuses for success over the years. But the persistent fear then is going to be that sooner or later you're going to be found out.
That you're going to be found out. Is that something that people are coming to you saying, I don't feel like I'm good enough to do what I'm doing?
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely. So what's interesting about imposter syndrome are these feelings of attributing whatever success or good things that happen to you to luck or to...
I like that computer error.
Yeah.
Oh, they must have given me a higher grade than I meant to get. Or maybe I shouldn't have got through this application process. It must have been a technical error.
Yes.
That nagging feeling of... I shouldn't really be here.
Yeah, that's in the audio clip, the idea of internalizing one's achievements. And I think what's important to say is there's imposter syndrome or imposter phenomenon, and it's, I think, more helpful to look at it as something along a continuum, because at any point in the day, any time in our lives, there are going to be times where we're out of depth, we're out of answers, we don't know if we're doing the right thing, we really are winging it. And the key difference between something like imposter syndrome, or you might even hear it referred to as neurotic imposter phenomenon, is that it becomes something where, you know, the person that is experiencing it sort of rides that wave and eventually can accept that, oh, you know, I might have done pretty well at that. That was something I put forward an effort, and this is the fruits of my effort. But when you on that continuum, when you get more severe sort of imposter syndrome, you have people that are unable to make those connections between the effort that they put forward, their own talents and capabilities, and the fact that they had a capacity to influence or directly affect the change or directly affect the success that they experienced. So it is a continuum. You know, you're in the grocery store with your kids and they have a reaction and you're sometimes just winging it. You're like, I have no idea what I'm supposed to do right now. Or you're at work and, you know, so you made a really insightful statement and someone says, oh, yeah, that was a really good idea. And you think, I have no idea where that came from.
Why do you think it's good?
Exactly. It's like, oh, was. But then with imposter syndrome, it's attributed to being a fluke or luck. There's nothing about you that caused that. That it was externally driven. So this idea, you internalize people that sort of overcome it, and to in varying degrees and varying ways, overcome it in the moment and say, you know, I really did work hard. Whereas other people attribute it to some external influence that, it was because I had an extra cup of coffee before I gave that presentation that gave me the energy. Or, you know what? It wasn't me. It was you. You did all the work. Yeah. So there's a lot going on.
So there's a tendency then to focus on perhaps the one thing that's gone wrong out of your day and really zone in on that. I think naturally we are drawn to focus perhaps on the negative instead of the positive.
Sure.
Our anxiety and fear, do they come quite naturally to a lot of people?
Yes, and they are natural. We need them. There's a difference between healthy adaptive fear and unhealthy maladaptive fear. Maladaptive is one of my favorite words because
maladaptive.
Yeah, maladaptive.
Talk me through that.
Oh, yes, I can't wait. So maladaptive is a way of acknowledging that whatever we're doing, it's unhealthy, but it's serving a function for us. So what I mean by this is the person who is worried about, you know, we'll use a presentation example. They're giving a presentation and they're worried about doing a good job. And so that fear takes on a characteristic where they are focused on just trying to have it be as perfect as possible. And on one hand, that's helpful in that they want, you know, it's going to help them do a good job. So in past circumstances, perhaps that, you know, may have worked, you know, where you have that critical talk. Oh, you don't want to mess up in front of everyone. You don't want to look like an idiot. You know, you better keep going. Oh, nope, you better not stop, because the minute you stop working on it, then, you know, things are going to blow up in your face. And that kind of self-talk has helped in some ways.
It can serve you.
It can, but then
it doesn't.
It doesn't, because it can take on a punishing tone where you become paralyzed by those fears. And so that's one way of looking at, you know, adaptive coping would be, I'm trying to do the best job that I can. Let me look at how can I, you know, put together this presentation. What sort of materials and resources do I need? And you're focused on the task at hand, but you're also realistic of what your expectations and your capabilities, and how to use those. Whereas the other maladaptive understanding of it is you are just incessantly trying. And the sad thing is no matter, when you're focused on the fear and running away from that feeling of fear, so I better work on it more, I better work on it more, so workaholic, you're running away from something. You're not actually working toward or running toward something that you want to do a great job on. You're trying to escape that feeling. And so a nicer example, I think that was a bit convoluted, a nicer example of maladaptive is looking at things like using alcohol to cope, where, you know, if you have these thoughts of sadness, anxiety, feeling that you're not good enough, and you drink, you temporarily suspend those thoughts, but they come back in a raging, raging way when the drink wears off. And so that's maladaptive, meaning you're using it to cope. It's not healthy for you. It's not actually addressing the problem. But it's more helpful to look at it from a maladaptive framework, because if you don't, then you end up saying, okay, well, you're drinking too much. Stop drinking. And it's like, okay, they know that.
Yeah. We're joined this afternoon by Chastity O'Connell, who's here as a mental health expert to answer any of your questions and queries. And we'd love to get you involved in the conversation here on the couch this afternoon. You can get in touch 4001. Or give us a call, 04-423-1010. Message that came in earlier said, but what if those fears and doubts about yourself are entirely justified? How can we tell the difference between a genuine fear or doubt and imposter syndrome? Chastity?
I love that question. So how to tell the difference between a genuine doubt or... So when we're looking at what are genuine fears, what I think sometimes is helpful is to zoom out and see what is it doing for us. So getting in that adaptive versus maladaptive. So if you think you're really not good at something and you're focused on that fear, you're focused on that thought, well, it's not going to necessarily do anything to change your behavior. And so if your intention is to try and improve, then, you know, the focus isn't, you know, it's trying to shift the focus off the fear. And naturally, when we're afraid, we focus on the fear. We focus on the thing that we're afraid of and we miss everything else. So context matters. So it's about trying to acknowledge that, look, I'm feeling vulnerable right now. I'm feeling really insecure right now. How can I zoom out and do something about how I'm feeling right now? And so there's nothing wrong with acknowledging that, you know, I'm not really good at this and I want to try and improve. And that's adaptive. But just beating ourselves up and saying, you're not really good, why can't you be better? That's where it's unhealthy fear.
Chelsea O'Connell, there's been a bit of a viral video going around, and Tom and his team were talking about it early on the agenda. And as a mental health professional, I really wanted to get your take on this as well.
Sure.
So Brian Thornhill, an American father, made his son run to school in the rain to punish him for bullying. This is fun. And it's got 25 million views now online. Yeah. He took a video from inside his car of his 10-year-old son running outside in the rain, posted it online, and basically his son was caught bullying other children on the school bus, and running was his punishment. I think we might be able to hear a little bit of that video. It's not playing. We'll grab it for later because it gets a little bit political towards the end, so we might give it a little chop. But punishment of this kind has really been the hot topic.
Mm-hmm.
Posting it online, also highly controversial. Chastity, as a mental health professional, can you unpick this for us?
Sure. It's so the video is kind of hard to watch in the sense that there's a lot that's going on with the father's characterization of what he's doing and his rationale for doing it, as well as there's some, as you mentioned, sort of political and controversial topics that are put in there as well. But what I will say is it brings up an interesting discussion about punishment. And ultimately, when we're looking at punishment, how it's been used in the past is as a way of trying to teach behavior. At the same time, we know from research, we know from lots of experiences that punishment does not teach. Punishment may stop behavior temporarily, but it doesn't teach. And so when you're looking at teaching new skills, teaching new behavior, because there's the assumption that children respond in certain ways to factors in the environment because that's all the skills that they have at that time. And so when you're looking to actually teach, punishment is not helpful at teaching them a new skill. So what's interesting about this video where he makes his son run in the rain to school is...
Do you know what, Chastity? I think we'll give people a little bit of a listen to it. So bear with us. Here we go.
Well, my son has finally gotten in trouble on the bus enough to where he got actually kicked off the bus for 3 days because he was being a little bully, which I do not tolerate, cannot stand. And therefore, he has to now run to school. We're right about 1 mile from the school. So all week, he has got the experience of running to school. The good news is, hey guys, he keeps up a pretty good mile pace at 6 miles an hour so far. Yesterday he was apparently a little rude for Michelle in the morning, so even though it's raining this morning, he still gets to run. This right here is just simple. You know, ironically, since he's been running to school this week, his behavior has been much better. His teachers have approved of his behavior this week. He hasn't gotten in trouble at school this week, where last week he was just absolutely out of his mind. But this right here is just old school simple parenting. This ain't killing nobody. This is a healthy way for a child to be punished because it's, you know, exercise, something that a lot of people don't think children should do anymore. So you just stick them behind a damn Xbox for the rest of their lives. So this right here is called parenting, guys. If you don't know what it's like, here you go. Teach your child a lesson. You don't have to kill them. You don't always have to beat them. But sometimes it sucks for them, and that's what teaches them.
I like the, you don't have to kill them. You don't even have to beat them. But now what I do take away from this video is that actually being a parent doesn't always mean being liked.
Absolutely.
And I think that is actually very valid.
Mm-hmm.
You do tend to have quite confused relationships where a parent will try to be a friend, and often that can serve nobody in that relationship. Now, exercise as punishment I have an issue with, because exercise shouldn't be punishment, and perhaps it could have been an opportunity for him to get involved and say, do you know what, you're not allowed on the bus for 3 days, but let's do this. Father and son will walk or run together.
Mm-hmm.
there is a photo on the, accompanying this article of him in bed with two cheeseburgers on his chest. So perhaps he's not, you know, the most healthy-minded himself. But perhaps that was a wasted opportunity. As you said before the clip, punishment does not teach, which is a bit of a light bulb moment for me as a parent, because that tends to be the go-to, mm-hmm. because it's quick. You hope it's a way of them acknowledging that they've done something wrong, or it's not a behaviour that you want to continue. But what does teach, Chastity?
Absolutely. So when we're looking at teaching new behaviours, we're looking at things like reinforcement. Reinforcement and feedback to our children. And so what I mean by that is, so what's interesting, you know, going and unpicking this video, is one of the things he's doing is he's acknowledging that his son was bullying someone else, another child. And as a parent, he's taking responsibility and ownership of how he's going to handle that, which I think is noteworthy. So of the things we like, that's one of the things we like. And that's at the same time, using the language of punishment, we, you know, like you said, and it's an excellent point, exercise is a wonderful way to teach. And so if it is this kind of thing, well, you've been having a problem on the bus, let's walk this out. You know, we're going to look at exercise. And in fact, for many types of struggles, exercise is a wonderful coping resource, whether it be depression, anxiety, helping children feel more centered at school and increase focus and attention. Exercise is wonderful. And so I think, Helen, your point on, you know, using punishment as an exercise or phrasing it that way, even though he's not actually doing that, but he's phrasing it as punishment, is a difficult one, because exercise is definitely a resource for so many people, and a healthy one at that. At the same time, you know, things that are difficult and what is challenging about the video is the inflammatory language and the references to beating. And so this is getting back into that punishment, what teaches and what doesn't. Reinforcement, you know, things like corporal punishment, hitting children, that may stop a behavior temporarily, but it's not filling the vacuum. So when you take away an iPad, when you tell a child to stop running, when you say stop hitting your sibling, what are you actually communicating? You're just saying what you want them not to do, rather than, can you talk kindly to them? Can you walk instead of run? And part of that might have to be like a more structured way of teaching, more like social skills. For example, if his son is having difficulty regulating emotions, it might be teaching coping strategies. So like exercise or breathing exercises, they're doing a lot of mindfulness exercises in school, and which is incredible, having lots of efficacy in helping children regulate intense emotions. And at the same time, you can pair that with social skill building. Like, well, if you want to be friends with someone, this is how you handle it. If you are interested in what someone else is doing, this is how you approach the situation. So there's opportunity for teaching, then reinforcing that behavior, and that reinforcement doesn't have to be tangible necessarily. This is where we get into the feedback. Children love to hear from us and that what they're doing is pleasing to us. And it doesn't mean like praising, saying, oh, you did such a great job. You were so smart. You're so wonderful. You're the best child ever. It can be as simple as, I liked how you shared with your sister. Very simple. And so especially for parents who might struggle with the idea of praise, why do I have to praise them for brushing their teeth? It is much more constructive to, and in alignment with someone's culture and values, to just give them feedback. I like the way you walked away from that kid who was in your face. That's not praising. That's not telling them. It's not praising them in the sort of traditional sense. It's that feedback of, I like what you're doing, and that's pleasing to me, and that there is nothing more powerful for a child than that.
We're joined this afternoon by Chastity O'Connell, mental health counsellor, who's here actually to answer your questions as well. We're talking about the big news stories and dealing with the issue of imposter syndrome. We're joined on the phone now by Saeed. We've got a question for Chastity. Can you hear me?
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi, good afternoon.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you. How can we help this afternoon?
Yes, I was listening to the broadcast, very informative, and I had some questions about myself. It may or may not be exactly imposter syndrome, but yes, some symptoms that I'm suffering from that a doctor highlighted is self-doubt and sense of failure. Like a huge sense of failure is always on my shoulders. And that entitles me to do some things that I think are may or may not be relevant to my personality that I would do normally. So once if I am faced with a self-doubt, obviously it proceeds by fear of failure in whatever I'm doing, particularly in my job. So the thing is, whenever, for example, if I have to do a task or if I have to call a person or follow up, so I have all these scenarios already in my mind that I may fail. What if the person doesn't like me? What if X, Y, Z happens? What if this happens? I cannot cope with it. I need to do something else. So this is the thing that has been bothering me for more than 3-4 years. I think if it is relevant, if I can get any advice or some, you know, closure on that.
Sure. Well, firstly, Syed, thanks for calling in, because, you know, what you're sharing is something that I think so many of the listeners can relate to, this idea that, you know, that we're going to fail before we've even started. And and the pain that comes from that can be overwhelming. And that pain can drive us to do things that, as you, I think you alluded to, that are out of alignment with our values, that are not what we want to be about. So I think one of the first things is, and it sounds like you've been going through this for 3-4 years, so that's quite a long time. So it might be worthwhile certainly reaching out to a professional and just sharing some of these concerns, just so you can get a sense of if there's more that can be done than what I'm going to share with you on the show today. But what I'll start off with is talking a little bit about sort of the masks that we wear. And so one exercise you could try at home is draw two circles, and in one of the circles, write all the things that you want people to see about you, the things that you work really hard to show. And it might be that you're, you know, competent employee, that you're hardworking, that you're friendly, that you care about, you know, the world around you. And so these are all the things that you want people to see. And then in the other circle, you can write all the things that you want to keep hidden, the things that you work super hard at keeping hidden, that self-doubt would be in there, that fear of failure, the fear that, you know, I'm never good enough, that I'm not going to be able to do a task, or if I do, it's just going to be a fluke and then I'll be back in square one, or, you know, people don't like me, whatever it is you're trying to hide, you put in that second circle. And when looking at those two things, it's important to just sort of sit with and acknowledge these parts of self, because I think oftentimes what people struggle with is that we don't have time to check in with ourselves, and we lack this self-awareness. We end up responding to the fear, responding to the emotion, responding to that self-doubt, but not really understanding it and not acknowledging that it's there. And so part of the step toward changing our response to it is acknowledging that it's there. So when you're looking at that in front of you, this is where we turn to compassion. And and you can call that what I keep hidden. You can call that inner critic. And the inner critic, we don't, you know, the inner critic is there. It's the maladaptive. I talk about that word, but it's the thing that serves a purpose. It's not always helpful for us, but it's there to protect us from being hurt. Because if you have self-doubt, so let's say you have a big project at work and you are feeling that failure, like, oh, I'm not going to do a good job. I'm not going to do a good job. Right. And so you might say something like, oh, I can't do it. Can someone else do it? Can my colleague do it? And so that's that inner critic saying, you can't do it. You're going to mess up. Why don't you quit before you mess up? And on one hand, that's going to protect you from the failure, but it's also keeping you away from what's in that first circle, which is that you want to be a good employee, that you want to do a great job. And so part of it is looking at what's in that circle, looking at that compassion toward that inner critic and saying, thank you. You are trying to protect me right now. I don't need your protection. I know self-doubt is something I'm struggling with. And sort of just bringing that self-doubt in, sitting it down, making it a cup of tea and saying, you're going to sit here with me and I'm not going to fight you, but I'm just going to, I'm not going to fight you. I'm just going to acknowledge that you're here, and sort of riding that self-doubt wave.
Does that help at all? Right. I have to say thank you so much for coming on and sharing that, because I think you've really echoed what so many people feel. And we talk a lot about comparing our insides to other people's outside.
Yes.
And I'm sure you're surrounded by friends and colleagues who are filled with the same self-doubts.
Yes.
And they just don't admit it either. So you sound very alone and you sound very tired. And I really hope that by acknowledging what you're feeling and reaching out, first of all, to us, which is a fantastic first step, but really exploring that and why you feel like that you'll be bouncing back and feeling confident, because three or four years is a very long time to be feeling down and insecure. So well done, first of all. So I think you've really achieved something today by talking about this. So
Thank you very much.
Do stay tuned. We're going to be talking more about imposter syndrome and how we can overcome it, and we're just wishing you all the very best. So thank you very much.
Have a nice afternoon.
You too. Thank you. We're joined this afternoon by Chastity O'Connell, mental health counsellor at the Human Institute in Clinic. And we want to hear from you and hear about your concerns and any issues, really just getting this conversation out in the open. Imposter syndrome is experienced by 70% of people and is very common amongst successful people. That kind of, am I a failure? Should I be doing this? Am I actually not qualified for this and surrounded by much more talented people than I am? Will my mask be ripped from my face and I'll be left exposed? It's fair to say a lot of people are feeling like this. You can get in touch 4001 on the text line to have your say, ask any questions. This is your chance for, think of it as a free clinic here this afternoon with Chastity O'Connell. So 4001 on the text line. We have had one come in, anonymous text message, and of course you can stay completely anonymous if you'd like to call us as well, 04-423-1010. Anonymous message saying, I'm at the stage where I should probably be feeling like a fully fledged adult. I own a house and a car and have a decent job and everything, but I feel like a lost little boy, and my reoccurring fear is that people will find out and I don't know what I'm doing. I'm starting to think that will never go away.
Wow. I think so many people can identify with that. You know, the heads nodding and the, you know, when will I be a full-fledged adult?
When?
Beautifully put.
When do we get that? We also got a message from Christian saying, when or at what age does parenting stop? And I think that ties in really nicely.
Yeah.
Probably never.
It doesn't. Sorry, Christian.
Sorry. it doesn't stop.
But
going back to that little boy lost feeling, and for men who often view themselves as being the head of the household and are often primary breadwinners, having that responsibility on your shoulders for your family and house, car, job, family, it's huge.
Absolutely. And one of the words that I don't love when it comes up, but it always says something to me, is when you use the word should. I shouldn't feel this way. Well, you do. And I think when we're talking about emotions, when we're talking about those feelings of self-doubt, those feelings of failure, we dislike it so much that, and we fight it rather than just letting it be and accepting it and saying, you're here, you're welcome. I know the more I fight you, the more you're going to stick around. So I'm just going to invite you in. It doesn't mean you're giving up. It doesn't mean you're succumbing to the pain. It just means that you're choosing to feel the pain and not engage in suffering. Pain is a part of life, and we all experience it. But suffering is when we try to fight that pain. It's when I don't want to feel this way. I shouldn't feel this way. Why can't I be grown up? Why can't I be? Look at how professional and polished and articulate and smart everyone else is on the planet, except for me. And when we do that, we don't make a space for that pain, and we end up acting in opposite. And when we act in opposite, we're not acting in alignment with our values, which draws us further away from the inner and the outer self being much more, having that outer self be representative of the inner self. It's like we're all vulnerable.
I think what was really interesting about what Saeed said on the phone and how you acknowledge this is this almost not wanting to do anything in case you fail.
Yes.
And you know, instead of feeling the fear and doing it anyway, which we, you know, we hear about a lot, but self-sabotage.
Absolutely. Beautifully put, Helen. Like, it's, and we, I think what's interesting is that we're not, to a certain extent, conscious of that. You know, if we had said to ourselves, you know, I am feeling really insecure right now, so I'm not going to put myself forward for that promotion, so I am sabotaging myself. No, it's sneakier than that. It just, it creeps in there because in parts in our past, it's worked. There's been times when you've, you know, not gone out for that sporting team or not, you know, didn't want to put yourself forward for the presentation, and you experienced relief when you did that. But it wasn't joy, it wasn't flourishing, it wasn't growth, it was relief. You were experiencing an absence of a negative emotion, not the presence of a positive emotion. And what's so cruel about it is that, let's say you put yourself forward for the presentation, this is where we get into this awesome imposter syndrome phenomenon. You put yourself forward, you do it, and you're like, I've only done this once, it must be a fluke. Like, I got really lucky.
Well, what I wanted to ask you, we're going to talk about this fully when we come back, is what's the difference between lack of confidence and insecurity? So to use that presentation as an example, if you're approached about a presentation or get invited to do a talk about something in your chosen field, and your first instinct is to go, oh no, I couldn't do that. Mm-hmm. Are you feeling lack of confidence, as in, I don't think I can stand up in front of people and say that? Or is it insecurity where you think, I don't know why they'd ask me to do that. I'm not qualified to talk about that. So is there a difference between confidence and security?
I think you just put it so perfectly, the way you phrased it, which was this idea that it's perfectly valid to, you know, have someone present you with a presentation and say, you know what, that's not my jam. I'm not really interested in doing that. And that, if it's in alignment with the inner and the outer. So what I mean is the inner may want to present, they may want to try this opportunity, but the outer is saying, I want to do it. The inner is saying, you're not good enough. Then that's that kind of, you're being driven by fear. But if you're driven by, you know, I'm not interested in that, I don't have the time for it, and you're making a decision based on what you're trying to work toward, which is, I'm not focused on that right now, I want to do this, very different. So, you know, and I don't know if that necessarily answered the self-confidence versus security, but...
It's Wednesday, it's Eye on Health, and I'm joined in the studio this afternoon by Chastity O'Connell, mental health counsellor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. This is your free clinic this afternoon, talking about imposter syndrome this afternoon. And earlier on, we talked about a big bullying story that's gone viral. We have had a text message about bullying this afternoon, Chastity. I'd just like to read this out to you. My daughter is 11 and really struggling with one girl at school who keeps picking on her. The other girl has a big personality and my daughter stands up for herself, but this girl is really upsetting her. The school is helping and aware, but ultimately nearly every day there's something that happens. What is the best advice for my daughter when she's upset by this girl in the playground?
So when looking at a situation like this, there's a couple of questions that I think might be helpful to keep in mind when approaching the school and when your daughter comes home. So when you mention that she's upsetting your daughter, in what ways is she upsetting your daughter? Is your daughter feeling sad afterwards, frustrated, isolated, angry? So putting some labels on the emotions so you can understand at what level is this response evoking a response in your daughter. And then we can look at things like building her emotional awareness of how she responds to these situations, as well as giving her some coping skills on if she feels frustrated and angry, then, you know, there are breathing exercises and, you know, walking away. If she's feeling sad and isolated, maybe it might look at, you know, reaching out to a teacher or ways to look for other friends that she can maybe engage with. So understanding the effect on her daughter is really important, specifically. And also, you mentioned she has a big personality. The bully has a big personality. So I'd like to know a little bit more about what does that mean? And so that'd be a good question to go back to the school or back to the teacher. What does big personality mean? Is it someone who is just very loud and outgoing and is sort of this overwhelming personality for everyone involved, or is it specifically targeted to your daughter? Is it, you know, and getting an understanding, because, you know, whenever you're working with a bullying situation, you work with the child that's bullied, and you also work with the bully and teaching them potentially social skills or how to handle difficult situations or how to manage intense emotions. So it's really important to understand what the bully and the bullied struggle with. And then lastly is asking questions about the teacher's response. Classroom management is key in either exacerbating or minimizing problem behaviors in the classroom. So is the teacher reacting to this by telling your daughter, oh, why are you worried? She wasn't messing with you. You know, you should just go play with someone else. Or is she coming down really hard on the girl with the big personality? That teacher response is really, really important. And once you understand what the teacher is doing, then it's a place for, from then you can talk about collaboration on what could be more helpful responses. Again, it's not about blaming the teacher. It's about really understanding if the teacher is telling your daughter, you know, why don't you just walk away? Don't let it bother you. Then we can handle that in a way that is more helpful. If she's coming down hard on the bully, then it may be a softer approach with the child that's bullied, or the child that is the bully, in a way to teach.
We talked earlier about this story coming out of the States, a guy whose son was bullying on the school bus and was taken off the bus for 3 days. The father filmed him running to school, and it's been watched 25 million times. The question I have for you about bullies, is it true that they're intrinsically pretty unhappy themselves, or perhaps are being bullied by someone in their own lives? Because my impression of this boy in the US is that his dad perhaps is showing some bullying behavior too. Mm-hmm. So is that a question? I mean, it's a difficult one when dealing with 11-year-olds, but trying to increase that understanding of perhaps they're suffering in their own way as well.
Absolutely. So what I'll say, bullying is so complex because bullying doesn't take place in a vacuum. It isn't that you have this child that is intrinsically bad and they come and sort of treat everyone badly. You know, there's usually a bully and the recipient, the victim or the bullied, the child who they target. And so there's something about that child who they're targeting that, you know, has some kind of vulnerability that's being attractive to the bully. So part of that is also teaching the child that's been bullied how, you know, some assertive skills on how to, you know, look after themselves, how to present, you know, bolster their self-confidence and self-esteem. But then there's also classroom management. And in some instances, it can be, children can be, in those situations, children that are bullies, there's something in the environment in that classroom that may be perpetuating that inadvertently. And so it's not the teacher's fault necessarily that they're making the bully, but how they may respond to the actions of that child and the actions of the victim could inadvertently exacerbate the situation. So this is where it's really important to get past the blaming questions. And I think ultimately that's what happens. It's like, oh, that child is bullying my child and it's their fault. It must be their parents. Their parents are bullied. And it's like, well, that's unhelpful right now, because if that child's only bullying in this class, they're not bullying at home, then clearly there is something about this environment that we really need to understand. And oftentimes it can be remediated with just some simple shifts and working with the children and working with the teacher and the classroom. So it's an awesome question, and I love that you brought it up.
We have had a question coming in anonymously saying, objectively, what psychological benefit or issues can faith being in control of the final outcome bring? So can faith help or hinder, to break that down to very basic terms?
That's a complex question, and it's an awesome one, because especially in this part of the world, people have a number of different spiritual or religious beliefs, and it's really important in their daily lives. So I would say there's an interesting, with faith and spirituality, there's a lot of research to suggest that spirituality can be quite helpful in terms of you know, fostering community, helping people feel connected, giving them a sense of purpose. And it can also promote feelings of acceptance. And acceptance isn't resignation. Acceptance is like, you know what, things are really tough right now, but I know I will make it through it. I have whatever belief system to get me through it. But then there's also a point at which religion can take on a tone where it diminishes our sense of responsibility. And this is where it can be complicated. And so it's really important to, when you're working with people with spiritual systems, to acknowledge and validate that importance, but also look for ways to draw helpful, to make that connection helpful for.
I hope that helps, but it's a big, big topic. Amazing, famous, multi-millionaire actor Mike Myers said, "I still believe that at any time the no talent police will come and arrest me." If this resonates with you, you could well be suffering from imposter syndrome like 70% of the population. We're getting into that more when we come back. Have you ever felt that you're about to be unmasked? Do you ever feel like a fraud? Do you feel out of your depth, unqualified, or less talented than the people around you? If you're nodding along, then welcome to the Imposter Syndrome Club. You're in good company. Around 70% of successful people have experienced imposter syndrome, including Maya Angelou, Albert Einstein, Meryl Streep, and even Will Smith. Here we have Oprah Winfrey talking to American author, social entrepreneur, political analyst, and decorated US Army officer Wes Moore. He's the author of The Other Wes Moore and The Work, both of which are New York Times bestsellers. Just have a listen to him talking about imposter syndrome.
So I feel like there's this common narrative that we don't belong certain places. Uh-huh. Where as we get to a certain level, it's kind of like, it's almost like this imposter syndrome.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Where we get to a place and it's like, you're just waiting for someone to tap you on the shoulder and say,
"What are you doing here?
What are you doing here? how'd you get in here?"
Did you feel that yourself
very
sometimes?
Very much so. Yeah. Oh, I mean, I felt it bad. Where with every accomplishment that I got, I just felt like I'm not supposed to be here. I think about when I was announced as a Rhodes Scholar. People are like, "Whoa, you're a Rhodes Scholar."
People say that even when they don't even know what it means.
You know what it means.
They just know, whoa, you smart.
But you know what it is. And my answer to them is always, but the Rhodes Scholarship was never intended for me. If Cecil Rhodes knew that I had received his money, this man would be turning. He wouldn't be just turning. He'd be doing backflips, side flips.
Would be a dancing emoji backwards.
Exactly. Yeah. All in his grave.
Yeah.
Because I was never the intended recipient. But I know how many people had to fight and work. And even if they didn't know me personally, they woke up every morning with the hope of me.
That is it.
With the hope of me.
Yeah.
And so when we have so many people who have this kill switch, this imposter syndrome, because they feel like I'm not worthy of this.
Don't you think that is because that there's so many people, and I'm thinking about in our own African-American culture, who don't really know the history. They don't really understand that somebody had the hope of you.
Yes.
And they don't really understand what Maya used to say that James Baldwin told her, that your crown has been paid for.
Mm.
And all you have to do is put it on your head and wear it. Don't you think it comes from not knowing where you've come from?
That's right.
Yeah.
And the power in which that we come from. And understand that we are never in a room that we don't belong in. We're not in a room. Whatever room that we're in, we're not in that room because of someone's benevolence. We're not in that room because of someone's social experiment. We're in that room because we belong there. And we then have to have that confidence that not only do we belong there, but we're not just there for wallpaper.
Yeah.
That was no less Wes Moore, American author, social entrepreneur, political analyst, decorated US Army officer, and also a victim of social imposter syndrome. I'm joined this afternoon by Chastity O'Connell, mental health counsellor at the Human Relations Institute and Clinic. And that just goes to show anybody is susceptible to this syndrome or phenomenon.
Absolutely. I love that you're using examples of Meryl Streep and Albert Einstein, Maya Angelou, Mike Myers, all of these people that we look up to, because I think it also causes a giggle in that you can
hide. It's incredulous, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And we know that humor can be incredibly healing and just take this sort of stress and tension out of what is a very painful and deeply sensitive topic. Feeling like you don't belong, you know, feeling like, you know, what am I doing here? I don't deserve to be here. It's painful. Social exclusion is painful. So when you hear Meryl Streep and you think, oh, how is this?
Meryl?
Yes.
Surely not.
It can't be possible. Yeah, so.
But it very much is. So we're talking about the social imposter syndrome this afternoon. Chastity O'Connell is here to answer any of your questions and concerns. So do think of this as being like your free clinic here on Dubai Eye 103.8. We'll talk now about Ibn Battuta Mall, 500 dirham voucher to spend on food and drink down there. This is part of the Dubai Food Festival, 500 dirhams to spend. And we're going to keep it really easy. Just send the word treat and your name 4001 or via the Dubai Eye Messenger app. So if you want to get in touch, that's the way to do it. We've had a message from John who said the best cure to imposter syndrome is realizing that everybody's an imposter. We're all just winging it.
Well said, John.
It's true, right?
Yeah.
But it's very easy to forget that. Mm-hmm. Now, relating to parenting, I thought this is an anonymous message that's come in. It said, I often feel like I'm not a good enough mother. It's only through admitting this to friends that I've realized that almost everybody feels like that. Can we talk about parenting and imposter syndrome, Chastity?
Yes, please. Good enough mother. I love that because Winnicott coined that phrase, and it's this idea that, you know, we're just trying to do the best we can with what we got. And in fact, it's not on us to be everything to our children, because there is the reality that they have to learn ways of self-soothing. They have to learn their own ways of coping. We can be there. We can be that holding space. We are that secure base for them to come back to in the world. But at the same time, you know, there is a point where, and there's a big overlap where we end and our children begin. And part of our journey as parents, and what makes it so beautiful, is learning that that boundary is permeable and also flexible. There are going to be times when they're 25 years old and they need us to hold them. Like they've gone through something really rough. And there are going to be times when they're 4 years old and they're like, no, I can brush my teeth by myself and I don't need you to wash my hands. I want to do it by myself. And it's just responding to them as an individual. So good enough mother is what we're shooting for.
Do you know what? Good enough mother would be fantastic. But my kind of parenting philosophy is, you know, done is better than perfect. But I do remember when my daughter was about one, having these really strong and very upsetting feelings that I was almost faking it as a mother, mm-hmm. and feeling that I wasn't good enough compared to anybody else around me. And I knew rationally that I was a mother. You know, there was a child sleeping in a cot and loads of plastic in my house and body returned. I'm never going to get back again. So I knew rationally that I was a mother, but I couldn't connect with feeling that I was doing it properly.
Sure.
And I felt like at any time someone was going to knock on the door, and I used to kind of think of them as being like the mum police, and they would always have clean clothes and clean hair and would ask me to make a fish pie and make sure that my child hadn't been watching rubbish on YouTube. I always felt like someone was going to come and bust me for not being I felt like I was faking it.
Sure.
And failing at it rather than nailing it. And of course there are fleeting moments where you feel like you're good enough and you're doing it and you're holding their hand and they ask for advice and they answer your question that you can answer and everybody's happy, but sometimes it can feel fleeting rather than continuous. So I think that feeling like an imposter in parenting is such a real struggle. And you know, I try and do what they talk about in yoga all the time, which, you know, stay on your mat. Try to not look around that class or look around your life or look around social media and compare what's happening in your life to other people's, because a lot of it is nonsense, for want of a better phrase. Mm-hmm. But to focus on what you're doing. But it's hard. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, it's hard to see parents doing what, you know, I'm actually feeling like looking, going, God, she really enjoys doing crafts with her kid. Oh, look, look what they baked. Or, you know, she's a real Pinterest mum. And I'm going, do not put eggshells in the batter. Or, you know, yes. I just do not want to see you this afternoon. You know, I want to go and read a book. I want to have a massage rather than rushing towards my child and wanting to play the tambourine for 4 hours. I don't know if these mothers exist, but it feels like they do.
They, I will say this, I'll say it proud. And I love that you're sharing this. We all feel this way.
Good.
And the minute you can say it loud and say it proud, then we can become a community of moms of sharing. But Pinterest is where dreams go to die.
It's a lovely thing in theory.
It is. It is. When you look at Pinterest, like there's this, I feel like there's this curve of emotion where you're just going to look for a kid's school project. And before you know it, you're planning or thinking about planning how to turn your garden into some plastic bottle project that has that generates or, zero waste.
Or a party that's just going to be so perfect. Yes. And cookies with icing that is, you know, just literally professional standards.
Yes.
It's fine for inspiration. For it actually is. Applying to life, setting yourself up
it's,
there.
It I is. Feel. It's where good intentions go. It's where moms go to feel bad about themselves sometimes. Yes.
It really is. I've had a few Pinterest wins. I made pancakes that look like bears. And that Ooh. Was, yeah, I know. Trust me.
Well
it was Instagrammed.
Done. Yeah.
But I feel like also people who are good Pinterest moms who live that life, I wouldn't be friends with them anyway.
Well, I'd want them to come and help me. That would be helpful. But it is, I think what's interesting, it's nice if you can hold two things. I think this is what's hard, is that it's hard for people sometimes to hold two opposite things at the same time. And so Pinterest, you go there, and we're all victim to it, where, you know, I'm just looking for some inspiration. I'm looking for some ideas.
And then you go down the like rabbit hole and 3 hours later.
Yes. And then you're reminded. And unfortunately, because it's hard to hold the fact that there are some really exceptional people doing exceptional things on Pinterest, and I can hold that. And also at the same time that I might be killing it as a mom, and I might feel that way approximately 37 seconds of every day. Holding those two at the same time is really hard. So it's this idea that I'm happy that you're doing that and I'm doing the best I can. So my birthday party is the one with the grilled cheese sandwiches and the donuts.
My kid's cake last week came from a packet. And honestly, that's fine.
See, it is. Yes.
It is. It's totally fine. I saw a quote the other day that really made me laugh. And it was like, I see these mums who do everything. And I just think, I should get them to do some of my stuff.
Yeah, they're amazingly talented. Amazingly talented.
Chesty O'Connell, we're talking about imposter syndrome this afternoon. And the more messages we get in, the more I realize everybody has it.
Yeah, we're not alone.
We're not alone. Official figures say around 70% of highly successful people suffer from imposter syndrome. What is imposter syndrome? In a nutshell, Chesty, can you just give us a quick recap?
So imposter syndrome is this nagging feeling that whenever you do something that you, instead of saying, I've worked hard for that, or taking some kind of responsibility or ownership for it, you attribute that success or that achievement to a fluke, being luck, or something external to you, that that it wasn't that you were doing it, that something, there was a chance that caused that success to happen. And it's also the fear that one day people are going to find out that you're a fraud, that you're incompetent, that you have no right to be there. And as you mentioned, the talent police are going to come knocking at your door and say, oh, you don't have a right to be here.
So. Or in my case, the mum police who will come in and figure out how much dry shampoo I use every week and be not fit to be a mother. We've had a message from Leanne saying, loving today's show and the chat on Pinterest. It's so true. We pulled out of the hospital with our eldest in the back as a newborn, laughing at the fact the hospital team thought we were savvy enough to know how to raise a kid. We could not believe that they let us leave. I think a lot of us had that feeling going, yes. they what? We're allowed to do what?
Yes. I am
not equipped.
I did not want to leave the hospital. It was like
me
my
either.
Safe haven. And, you know, people brought you meals.
You just press a little button and a nurse would come and tell you what to do.
It was
And then
wonderful.
You want to take that child home and be a mum.
Yeah.
And what I found actually is a lot of the kind of antenatal classes really just covered you through pregnancy. and the birth, mm-hmm. but not actually looking after such a child. Yeah.
Not the fourth trimester. I mean,
exactly.
They're,
and those 3 months, it's, you know, the struggle is real, especially when you're here and you're far from home and you don't have the help and support around you that you would do in your home country.
Absolutely. And you have this element of, you know, people that have had children and are having children, in some ways, the age is shifting to later and later in life, where they've had other experiences where you've experienced success, where you know what it feels like to have something start to finish.
You're probably accomplishing your career by your mid-30s, if that's when you choose to have children.
Yes.
And you're in control.
Yes.
And then you chuck a kid in the mix.
And no one vetted you for it. No one interviewed you to see if you were a suitable candidate. And then all of a sudden you're hired when you give birth. And then you are now endowed with this incredible gift responsibility. Absolutely. So it is so natural for you to feel overwhelmed and completely out of your depth months, years after taking that child home from the hospital, especially if you've had other past experiences where you have felt a sense of success, gratification, competence, and have had feedback for it. Like, oh, you did really well.
Who gives you feedback on being a parent?
I do.
Do you? Yes. We'll talk later. I could do with a bit of validation, Shasti. Yeah. We've had a message from Amy saying, I totally agree. I often feel a bit flat, especially when it comes to children in the afternoon. I often tell my children to leave me alone, go away, etc., and then feel guilty. The kids are fine, but how do I stop feeling the guilt?
Oh my goodness.
Not alone there, Amy.
No, not at all. And I think the first step is just acknowledging the guilt and trying to understand where is it coming from? Is it because you don't feel like you're doing enough? And again, that feeds
enough,
into...
Enough? Like, what does that even mean?
Exactly. Because oftentimes when you start exploring and picking away at these sort of feelings of self-doubt, feeling that we're not good enough, feelings of guilt, feelings of shame, feelings of should, people shoulding on themselves, they are often accompanied by a lack of reality. And so it's almost like running a marathon that has no finish line. And so nothing you do, if you don't have a sense of where you're going and what your values are, nothing you do is going to be good enough. And so this feeling of guilt will still be there lingering. And if you think again about the function of these feelings, that guilt is maybe going to drive you to try and, you know, do other things. So in some ways it might have helped engage your behavior, but over time, if you don't embrace and experience and give yourself compassion to sort of recharge, then there is going to come a point when you just feel like nothing I do is good enough for me. Nothing I do is good enough for me.
That sounds exhausting.
It is.
We've had a message coming in for you, Chastity O'Connell, on 4001 saying, before marriage and a few years after it, I worked as cabin crew at a leading airline. It was always my dream and I loved it. After having my first baby, I willfully gave up my job to look after my family. I had a second baby a while back and continued to be a housewife. Lately, in the last few months, I've begun to miss my career. I know I can't join back as my kids are still young. However, each passing day, I get more irritable with everyone around me removing frustration in the wrong way. My ambitious side is coming back and I feel helpless. I can't leave my kids alone, but I don't know how to settle this nagging feeling. That's a big topic. Mm-hmm. But is there any advice you can offer?
So what I would say is, in first asking some questions about, you know, what is it that you're looking for? So returning to the workforce, the career, and what's holding you back? Is it the time that you've had out of the workforce? And that's a real issue. There have been some excellent articles talking about returnships or re-entry positions where you have moms returning from work, returning from staying at home and, you know, getting some experience in the field before returning to a position. And part of that is there is a big hiring bias, you know, hiring reentry individuals, hiring mothers who have taken time off. So it's looking at what are the barriers. Is it something that there isn't family support? Is it that financially there isn't someone to look after the children, so childcare and school? Or is it that are the barriers internal? Is it that you don't think you should go back, that you should stay at home. And sometimes when we start unpacking it, it helps us get out of the black and white, which is, I should just stay home or I should go to work full time. And although it is a challenge finding those part-time opportunities, you might find, you know, volunteer opportunities might provide, start to provide that outlet, that sense of satisfaction that you derive from your job.
It's also identity as well, I think, a lot of the time.
Yes, that's one of my favorite words. And I think all too often we don't acknowledge the role of identity. And in fact, it's one of my areas of keen interest, which is maternal identity formation. How do we integrate our previous selves, our mother selves, our wife selves, our daughter selves? We're someone's daughter too. How do we integrate these different roles in a way that is still healthful for us, but still honoring the fact that we do have them and we do have some responsibilities.
And also, you know, carrying a lot of plates or indeed wearing a lot of hats.
Yes.
I mean, speaking personally, I went from kind of fiance to wife to mother within about a year.
Wow.
And yeah, my head was spinning, completely spinning. It's a really hard thing to reconcile, to go, okay, I'm going to have a kid, but I had this life before that that I want to acknowledge and continue. Mm-hmm. And how do I put those hands together, so to speak? So it is a really complicated one. But for our listener, really kind of looking at what you need from that job and seeing if you can seek it from somewhere else, or if there's a timeline in place in the future where you could go back.
Absolutely. And I think you were alluding to this. Is it that you're experiencing this sense of sort of frustration and dissatisfaction now? And sometimes we look back and think, oh, when I was flying and I had this freedom. So, you know, there is this element that what we thought we were getting from it, you know, we're in a place of frustration. And so what our current mood is going to color how we perceive.
Grass is always greener. It's an easy way of putting it.
It is. So instead of, you know, looking at more looking at what you need, what is it that you're hoping for? What are some of the barriers and what can you do about it? Is there small steps and not going either or? There's so many times working with individuals in therapy where it's like, I either break up or I stay together. I either leave my job or I take a new job. And it's, well, there's a lot in between there, and let's look at that.
Now, the philosopher Bertrand Russell wrote, "The whole problem with the world is that fools and fanatics are always so certain of themselves, and wiser people so full of doubt." We are talking about imposter syndrome this afternoon with Chastity O'Connell, shedding a bit of light into what is actually a very common problem. Mm-hmm. Now, I want to run something past you here, Chastity.
Okay.
Fiona Buckland is a life coach from the UK, and she has written that British clients are less inclined to own success for fear of being labelled arrogant compared with Americans. She says women and people from minority populations also experience imposter syndrome more due to cultural inequalities. So I wanted to ask you about that feeling of otherness and if that could perhaps contribute to the feeling of really like you don't belong in a room or a position.
Sure. Well, they're certainly related. And what's interesting is drawing in the sort of cultural realities of imposter syndrome and how that gets, manifested in cultures. And what I mean by that is, how do you show someone in the UK that you really appreciated what they did and how does that differ than how you might show someone what you appreciated in India or in the US or in Germany? So there's all of this imposter syndrome. It takes place within that cultural context. So I think it's interesting and awesome to sort of draw that reality. You know, are you saying stiff upper lip or are you...
It's always a bit of tall poppy syndrome is a big thing in the UK.
Sure. So, and there is, particularly in Far East Asian cultures, this idea of... collectivist versus individualistic society. So when you're looking at what your achievements mean for your collective group versus what your achievements mean for you as an individual. So all of that plays into our individual experience of imposter syndrome. So whether or not you take ownership for it. So you were mentioning the UK example, you know, not wanting to be seen as arrogant, whereas maybe the same sort of imposter syndrome manifesting in an American might be, yeah, I really killed it on that. I really did a great job. When privately you're thinking, I just need to say that I am cringing now that I actually said that, and now I have this internal monologue that I can't stop, that I can't silence. So looking at the cultural reality of imposter syndrome. But what I also wanted to highlight, what you mentioned, is this difference between minority groups and women and what males may experience in terms of imposter syndrome. So what we know from the research is that women and minorities tend to feel a sense of proving themselves. So proving that they deserve their place at the table, and then working twice as hard so that people don't assume that it's a fluke. So there's this experience of, oh, you were hired because you're a woman or you're a minority, and needing to prove that that's not the case. So you end up trying to do twice as much just to prove that you deserve to be there. So yeah, there is a socioeconomic reality to imposter syndrome too.
So the imposter syndrome term was coined by two American psychologists, Clance and Imnes, actually two females, in 1978. And they actually initially thought it was only experienced by high-achieving women, but quickly found that men experienced it too. This is now a subject expert called Dr. Valerie Young, who said that women are more susceptible to imposter syndrome feelings because they internalise failure and mistakes, whereas men are more likely to attribute failure and mistakes to outside factors. Mm-hmm. You're nodding along, Chesty.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's how, and the experience is there, but again, how it gets enacted varies from individual to individual, and there are some similarities or commonalities depending on gender, depending on cultural groups. So for example, the male experience, you mentioned externalizing blame, or if they're feeling these imposter syndrome feelings, you know, after work, going to the bar, whereas maybe women, after feeling these imposter syndromes, might call up a friend and do, you know, reassurance seeking, like, I did this, and then she said this, and then I said that, and then I told him that I'm not going to take that anymore. So did I do the right thing? Was that okay? So again, how we sort of handle this, and I don't mean to break it into stereotypes, I'm just talking in generalities. There are some subtle differences in how we experience this. But as you mentioned earlier, it's common across the board. And it's fascinating to see it, you know, some of the research as it relates to university graduates that have been selected into top universities. You know, you have Harvard, Stanford, Oxford, and 70-80% of them attributing their admission to a fluke, that somehow
they've got through the cracks.
They did. Their application was stapled to the application of the super smart kid, and they just said, okay, well, yeah. Well,
let them in.
Yeah, let's just let
highly
them in.
Unlikely. Yeah. But if you ever feel like a fraud, or you're out of your depth, unqualified, less talented than the people around you, you're certainly not alone. According to some estimates, up to 70% of successful people have experienced imposter syndrome, including Maya Angelou, Albert Einstein, and Meryl Streep. So you are in good company. Talked about Dr. Valerie Roberts, who is an expert and author on the subject. Here she is talking about it.
It was two psychologists in the late 1970s, Dr. Pauline Clance and Dr. Suzanne Imes, who first coined the term the imposter phenomenon, as it is more accurately known in the world of psychology. And they found in their research at a university in Georgia, despite overwhelming, compelling evidence to the contrary, a lot of perfectly intelligent, capable, competent people have a really hard time internalizing or really owning their achievements. And instead, they discount them or diminish them and kind of chalk them up to things like luck, timing, connections. They just like me, computer error. I've heard some very creative excuses for success over the years. But the persistent fear then is going to be that sooner or later you're going to be found out.
You're going to be found out. I think that's a niggling feeling that a lot of people have. And actually, Mike Myers, the actor, has been quoted to say, I still believe that at any time the no-talent police will come and arrest me. I think you're safe, Mike. Don't worry. Joined in the studio this afternoon by Chastity O'Connell, mental health counsellor, who's here on hand to answer any questions or queries that you might have regarding mental health here live in the Dubai Eye studio until 2 o'clock. We have had anonymous text message, and of course you can remain completely anonymous. See if we can get to this one. Is it possible to be suffering from mental illness without recognizing the problem?
Yes, it is. And that's an excellent question. And delighted that someone's bringing that up. And that can happen for a variety of reasons. I think with that question, people might assume the more severe disorders like maybe the personality disorders, narcissistic personality disorder comes up quite often. And that part of that presentation is that people don't recognize that they're having a problem. And it might be the spouse or the parent that recognizes that something's going on. But we also see this with the more traditional disorders like depression and anxiety. Because what happens or what can happen is that people are functioning with these disorders for such a long time that they internalize that this is what life is like. Life is so hard. It is like breathing in mud every day. And so this is, I just need to chin up, get on with it, and keep plugging and plugging and plugging away at it. And oftentimes with things like depression and anxiety, it's a family member that will say, you know what, you haven't been the same since this. I think you need to reach out and get some help, because you may experience the onset of that disorder gradually, where it just sort of creeps up on you. Depression is like that, where it just all of a sudden you went from, you know, feeling like capable, confident, to I find it hard to get out of bed. And so it just sneaks up on you. So yes,
it
awesome
is possible.
Question. Yes.
Okay. Chastity O'Connell, we're talking about imposter syndrome this afternoon. You're also on hand to answer any mental health questions. We have got a phone call for you. Good afternoon.
Hi. Good afternoon, guys.
Can you hear us okay?
Yeah, I can.
Great.
Can you hear me?
We
properly?
Can. Can you tell us you've got a question for Chastity?
Yes. I've had this habit of biting down on my finger edges near the nails, you know, the skin of my fingers, and I mean as much as I hate it, I just am not able to control it at all. Like there will be times that my fingers look like shredded piece of chicken, you know, and it's really really it comes across bad when I'm talking to somebody and I have to kind of hide my hands. And it's not something that I do on purpose. It just keeps happening. I try to stop myself in the moment sometimes, and I say, oh, you're doing it again. Stop it, stop it, stop it. And then I'll just stop it at that time. And then, I don't know, it just happens again. And my hand just goes to my teeth, and I start, you know, just fidgeting with it, and it's very very bad, and I really really want to stop it, but I'm just not confident enough, or I just don't know how or what I could do to really stop myself from doing that.
Okay, thank you so much for coming on this afternoon and opening up about this. Chastity, how can you help about compulsive behaviours, which it sounds like this is?
Sure. One quick question about how long has this been going on for you?
Years.
Years. Okay.
Lots of years, yeah.
Lots of years. And how have you coped with it before? It sounds like it's getting worse now. Am I correct in my understanding of that?
It's just, it's been the same. I mean, it's not worse.
Okay.
It's just always been the same. I mean, I'm very bad right now already at it, and it's always been like that. I think I can't even remember how long ago or how it started, but I just know that it's bad, and I really, really need to stop it.
Sure. Well, I just want to applaud you for reaching out today and sort of sharing your experience, because I do think a lot of folks are struggling with behaviors that they feel that they have no control over. And so at the same time, you know, it sounds like you're experiencing a lot of pain and distress from this, that you're trying to stop it. I would imagine that you've tried a number of things in the past to stop this.
I've tried to a couple of things I tried was like I put band-aids on all like one or two of my fingers that I really really fidget with more than the others, and until I have those band-aids on, I just keep fidgeting with the band-aid, but I don't like my fingers don't go to the mouth. But like it's only until the time that there's something on my fingers already, or I'm and you know what, I've noticed, or my wife's noticed more, that even if I'm sleeping, sometimes in my sleep it just happens.
So it's,
you know, it's very very involuntary.
Okay, wow. And when you are doing the biting, what are you thinking about? What are the thoughts that come to your mind?
It could be everything. I am watching a movie and it just happens, or I'm just driving in the middle of, I don't know, I'm listening to the radio and it happens. So it's nothing specific. And that's what worries me, because I used to earlier think that maybe I'm thinking about my job, or maybe I could be worried about my job or something in my life, and that could be the cause. But to be honest, I mean, it's nothing that specifically triggers it for me.
Okay. And how do you feel after you've, been biting on your fingers? What are your thoughts, reactions, feelings?
The only thing I think is, oh my God, I look at my finger and I'm like, oh, I really made it worse, you know, and that I just need to stop, and I stop at that time, but it just involuntarily after a while, maybe I'm somewhere or doing something on my laptop or something, and it just happens without.
Sure. Well, and it's, you know, because this has been going on for such a long time, and it sounds like it's bringing you a lot of distress. You mentioned it, you mentioned your wife, and that you've tried many times to try to control it. I would recommend getting in touch with a professional that has experience in helping individuals work with behaviors that they find it difficult to control. So again, you've been suffering, it sounds like, for a long time, and it's bringing you embarrassment because you're trying to cover your hands, and that's painful. And unfortunately, that stress and pain that you feel as part of that can exacerbate the condition. So, you know, I really encourage you to reach out. There's a number of great clinics in Dubai where there's experts that can help you find different strategies to look at the behavior, look at what function it's serving for you, and give you coping skills on how to cause this shift.
Listen, do I need to find a so what are you saying is, do I need to speak to a psychiatrist or a behavioral expert?
So I would say start with a psychologist. There are a number of great clinics, and ask them if, when you're talking with them, a number of them will help screen the call at the receptionist will. So just explain your situation and share what you've shared here, which is you have this behavior that is causing you distress. It's been going on for a long time, and you really want to try. You've tried a number of things, and you want to try and get through it and work through it and resolve it. So
Chastity, would it be worth speaking to a GP first in terms of referrals to make sure insurance is able to cover?
That's an excellent point. So it's definitely worth talking with your GP and talking with your insurance company. Sometimes you can reach out to them directly and ask them if they cover it. Sometimes they'll maybe ask you, if it's mental health related, to start with a psychiatrist first. At the same time, a psychiatrist will be helpful, but it's also important to have that behavioral therapy. And I love that you mentioned, you know, a behavior therapist. So I would suggest contacting a psychologist or a clinic, and then the psychologist can refer on to a psychiatrist. But then if, you know, certainly with insurance and cost, you can start with your GP first.
I really hope that's helped this afternoon. And thank you so much for coming on and opening up about that. Wishing you all the very best.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much, guys.
Thank you.
It's a wonderful topic, and I really hope I can get somewhere there. Thank you so much.
I'm sure you can. Thank you. I'm Helen Farmer. I've been joined in the studio this afternoon by Chastity O'Connell, mental health counsellor at the Human Institute Relations Clinic.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcast at DubaiEye1038.com.